Why is Miami-Dade County at such high risk for a measles outbreak? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-Dade and Broward counties are listed in the top 10 counties in the country at greatest risk for measles to spread. We're going to talk to the researchers from Johns Hopkins University about findings from a new study and what we can do to reduce that risk. Also, there's a new texting while driving law that makes it a primary offense. It got bipartisan support and is awaiting the governor's signature. But will that be enough to convince drivers to put down their phones while behind the wheel? And Dave Barry has a new book out. It's called Lessons from Lucy. It's all about many of the lessons he's learned from his dog. We're going to share some of those today and some of the lessons that you've gotten from your pets that you shared on Facebook and Twitter. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, the measles outbreak in the U.S. has reached a 25-year record. According to the Centers for Disease Control, more than 800 people have been infected with the virus nationwide. That may not seem like a lot, but the CDC declared the virus eliminated back in 2000. A new study out of Johns Hopkins University and the University of Texas at Austin examined the counties at the highest risk for disease spread. Miami-Dade County came in third, Broward County seventh. Dr. Lauren Gardner is an associate professor of civil engineering at Johns Hopkins University. She was the corresponding author for the report, and she's going to explain why South Florida is at such high risk. She's joining us now from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Gardner, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
You know, let's start by the fact that you are approaching this research as a civil engineer. Why did you want to look specifically at the spread of measles?
Yeah, that's not the first time that I've been questioned about where my job title is. But so I study infectious disease spread around the world, but in particular, the role that travel contributes to this. And so we've looked at a few different diseases in the past, and the reason that we were interested in measles in particular is because I think it's important to note we shouldn't be seeing any measles outbreaks in the U.S. It's a disease that's been eliminated for almost 20 years, as you noted. And the only reason that we see a measles outbreak is because two things happen. One of those is measles has to get imported into the U.S. from an infected traveler. That typically comes from a country abroad where they're having a large measles outbreak, where measles is likely endemic. And the second thing that has to happen is this introduction has to come in to a location in the U.S. where there's a susceptible population. And this means there's unvaccinated people, and the introduction can then spread and spawn a local outbreak. And unfortunately, that's exactly what we've been seeing this year in 2019.
From your research, I wondered if all diseases behave the same way.
No, they don't all behave the same way. I do think that travel plays a pretty critical role in the spread of a lot of different diseases, and that's travel globally, that's travel locally. However, measles in particular is very contagious and spreads from person to person. Things like Zika and dengue that we've previously looked a lot at spread through an infected mosquito. And so when you model those and you model how they spread, you have to take these things into consideration.
So looking at your list, two of the top 10 counties that were on there are South Florida counties, Miami-Dade and Broward County.
Yes.
You look at this list, just let's talk about some of these factors in what makes these counties unique and puts them in the top 10. Why? Why are we so high?
Right. So when we built this model, we took into consideration the things that I mentioned before. So where are measles outbreaks happening in the world? And right now there's really large outbreaks, over 100,000 cases of measles reported this year in countries all over Europe, in places like the Philippines and Thailand and Madagascar, Ukraine, Israel in particular. And so at the same time, these countries are very connected to the U.S. through travel. And then the third factor is the vaccination rates in the U.S., and these vary quite a bit county to county and state to state. And so it's a combination of these factors that determines which places are most at risk. So we found that using this model, a lot of the major outbreaks, the regions where these major outbreaks were, like in Washington, Oregon, and New York, were flagged. We saw similarly the places, quite a few cities in California and Texas as well, that were identified. And then in places like Florida in particular, and also in Chicago, these are places where they haven't necessarily seen a lot of outbreaks or seen cases yet, but we're suggesting that the risk there is high and they are likely to see cases. And this is mainly due to where the travel is coming from.
Yeah, because I wondered about that. Looking at the list, I thought, wait a second. I mean, like Washington, D.C., Boston, these are big airports.
I mean,
not to say MIA is a very big airport. Broward, the Fort Lauderdale airport, is getting bigger, but it's not as big. But so I wondered how much of a factor was the travel part.
Right. It's a huge factor. So it really is a combination of all these things that fit together. It's really not explained by any one. But in particular for Florida, it's driven by the size of the airports, but specifically where the travelers are coming from. And I actually dug a little into the data before this to take a look at where they were coming from. And it's a bit different airport to airport, but mainly Broward County and Miami-Dade in particular are servicing a lot of travelers from the Philippines and Thailand, Ukraine, Israel, and also from a handful of countries in the Americas that have reported suspected cases of measles. And because we were doing this analysis in real time, we're using the suspected cases reported to the World Health Organization so far this year. And so there were, you know, hundreds of cases reported in places like Mexico and Cuba. And those places are very connected to these cities in Florida.
Yeah.
So it may turn out, you know, down the road that these suspected cases are not all confirmed, in which case the risk posed to Florida might be less. At the same time, the exemption rates that we considered, our vaccination rates, are actually probably increasing over time and may actually be even higher than some of the rates that we used in this model. So
now, that is one of the issues in Miami-Dade County. It centers around temporary medical exemptions when children are able to opt out of getting their measles vaccinations until later. Are we able to factor those rates into, you know, this particular research? Specifically when you're looking at these temporary exemptions?
Yeah, so that was a huge consideration for us, and that was really one of the main motivating factors behind looking into measles and doing this research, is that we were really concerned about the pockets of unvaccinated individuals around the U.S. And we did consider Florida's non-medical exemption rate in this study. I think we're planning to kind of build on and expand this to get more recent, more current exemption rates at a more refined scale as well. But it is factored in.
I'm talking with Dr. Lauren Gardner, Associate Professor of Civil Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Gardner was a corresponding author for a new study examining the counties nationwide facing the greatest threat to measles. Again, facing the threat. There's been more than 800 cases of the virus this year nationwide, according to the CDC. Interesting to note, by the way, Dr. Gardner coming back, is that you had mentioned it too a second ago, is that You successfully were able to track the spread of Zika a few years ago, which again was a big issue here in South Florida.
Yes, nothing against Florida, that it was flagged.
We're
in
used
of
to
these
it.
Studies.
That's okay.
Yes.
That's all right.
It's very interesting. They're like I said earlier, they're very different diseases. One spreads directly through people, one spreads through a mosquito. But we use a very similar mathematical modeling framework to model the risk of both. We look at where these outbreaks are happening all around the world, how travel connects these places. The main difference between the two is that for measles, we worry about the risk as a function of how many people are unvaccinated in a given location. Whereas in Zika, we worry about the presence of a particular species of mosquito being present in a particular location. But mathematically, they're actually very similar problems, and we were able to pretty accurately identify what were the places that were likely to see Zika outbreaks back in early 2015.
So we're living in a county that is at high risk. You've been working with researchers to develop policy prescriptions to reduce the spread and the threat of measles. So what are some of these ideas that we should be considering?
Right. I think there's quite a few things that can be done and should be considered. The first and foremost one is that we need to increase vaccination rates. And this can be done through a few different measures. But the biggest issue that this faces is that there is misinformation about vaccines. And it is particularly problematic in certain communities and groups of individuals where there are really low vaccination rates, primarily because people seem to overestimate the risk of vaccinations and they underestimate the risk of not getting vaccinated. And so this misunderstanding needs to be addressed through educational campaigns to try and improve awareness and incentivize people to actually choose to vaccinate for themselves.
Have you ever been in touch with a person who is an anti-vaccination person, or even now you have another group that's the Safe Vax movement? Have you ever run into anyone in any of these, I guess, movements or however you want to list them, and talk to them about this? Not necessarily for research.
Yet.
I just think you personally, if you have.
No, I don't know if it is a natural selection process or what, but I am not surrounded by many people that share that belief. It's a very good question, and I'm actually very interested in talking to more people that do share that belief to try and understand why, because because I do think that people are generally trying to do right and they're not trying to harm others, which is what happens, unfortunately, when they don't vaccinate. And so I really think that it's about helping them better understand the problem, understand the science, understand the implications of their decisions.
You know, as I said before, that you are approaching this, your background is in civil engineering. How does that change your approach to the study?
So I don't come at it necessarily with a traditional public health or medical approach, and I look at it really as a systems problem. So to me, this is a bunch of layers of information and risk factors that together implicate certain outcomes. And so I really see it as this layer of how people move around the world and how different parts are connected, how large measles outbreaks or whatever it is that we're modeling are, what's happening at the origins and destinations of these travels, and different factors in each of these locations and each of these types of connections. So I think of it really as a systems problem more so than a medical problem.
My understanding is you want to expand your study to include other viruses that are linked to vaccines. What are the next steps in the research?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a very flexible and transferable model, and it can be applied in other locations. It can be applied to diseases such as mumps and pertussis, other vaccine-preventable diseases that spread through travel where we know there's high risk of importation of these diseases, and populations at risk here because of low vaccination rates.
Again, talking with Dr. Lauren Gardner, Associate Professor of Civil Engineering at Johns Hopkins University, one of the authors for a new study examining the counties nationwide facing the greatest threat of measles spreading. And Miami-Dade is up there in the top 10. So is Broward County. Dr. Gardner, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, there's a new law against texting and driving. Will it convince drivers to be safe? We're going to talk to the lawmaker behind that law coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. For those of you listening to us on the road during your lunch hour, I've got a question. Are you also on your phone? Are you texting? How often do you find yourself texting while driving? Or look around you. How many people are doing it? Well, there's a new law in Florida awaiting Governor DeSantis' signature that would make it a primary offense if you get caught doing just that. And it'll go into effect July 1st. We've been asking you how this law is going to change behavior. We heard from Debbie Wanenkoff from Key Biscayne. She lost her son Patrick to a distracted driver in 2015.
It will hopefully change the culture around distracted driving, making it unacceptable, just like drunk driving.
We want to hear more of your thoughts. You can text in those thoughts at 305-602-2646, 305-602-2646, or you can tweet us at WLRN Sundahl. Joining me now is the representative who's been fighting for this law now for a couple of years, Democratic Representative Emily Schlossberg from Boca Raton. She's joining us from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Representative Schlossberg, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
18 other states in the U.S. have passed this law. Why do you think that we have taken so long to make distracted driving a primary offense?
You know, this is common sense legislation, and this is legislation that affects every single Floridian and guest in our state. So it's a huge deal. You know, while most legislation affects a small segment or a business segment of our state, this affects everyone. And it's a bit controversial, so it just takes a lot of work to get something like this on the books. It took getting the seatbelt law from a secondary to a primary over like 20 years. So it just takes time.
This law is personal for you. You started the Dori Schlossberg Foundation, and this is because of the horrific crash back in 1996. It took the lives of four teenagers, including your twin sister. Why do you think it's been such a challenge to get people to think about safety when driving? Because as you said, the seatbelt law took so long.
It takes a long time. I mean, because the legislation does affect everybody, and you know, it's not really until you lose somebody or it happens to you is when you become an advocate for it. You know, there's just so many different viewpoints here. We have certain, like the Libertarian Caucus, who just says we don't need any more legislation on our books. We don't need any we don't want to be told what to do in our cars. And then we have other caucuses who just have their own personal reasons against it. Some people just want to text and drive, and you know, it's like something similar to, you know, it just takes time for common sense legislation to get through.
Now, this time around, 2 years ago, you couldn't get a committee to listen to it. This time you had bipartisan support, and the governor has said, yeah, I'm for this. What changed so quickly?
You know, that's a good question. I have to give a lot of credit to our governor for, stating that he is going to be on board and not veto it. You know, it's about working all of the members, going through each legislator, sitting them down and talking to them and getting everybody to be on board to not actively oppose it. I mean, it's difficult to find this compromise. You know, I filed this legislation as a local bill. As a local bill for school zones, I filed it as an amendment. I filed it as a regular bill. I called for special session last year. I filed it again as a bill. I filed it, you know, I just kept filing it as anywhere I could file it. I tried to file it, and you know, it just took getting all of the legislators' personalities, everybody together, and that's what we managed to do.
Real quickly, let's go over what this law says, because now it makes it a primary offense. Before, a police officer could pull you over, but it had to be for something else. They could cite you for this. Now they could stop you just for this, just for texting and driving. But just briefly, give us a little bit of the overlay of what the law is now.
Right. So if a law enforcement officer sees a driver texting, they can pull that driver over and issue a citation. There are exceptions written into the statute for if you're stationary at a light, there's an exception for that. If you're using your navigation, there's exception for that. If you're using the phone for an emergency purpose, there is an exception for that. If you're emergency personnel, there's also an exception for that. And a first violation, what you can do on a first violation is similar to like a non-moving violation, but a second violation will be a moving violation and points will be assessed. Also, in school zones and in construction zones, it will be hands-free. So you'll have to be using something such as like a Bluetooth. You can't really be touching the phone inside of school zones and construction zones while workers are present.
We want to hear your thoughts. A new law, again, on texting and driving. Is this going to be enough to change our habits, our behaviors? 305-602-2646. That's 305-602-2646. 602-2646. Let us know your thoughts. Patrick from Delray Beach says, I drive for sales and I need to use Google Maps or Waze. Will I get a ticket for maps on my phone? This goes back to the GPS point, I think, right?
Yeah, correct. There's an exception written into the legislation for GPS.
Okay. By the way, how will police decide if a person's texting or, you know, to differentiate someone isn't just answering their phone or looking for directions or that they're texting?
Right. That's, you know, after discussions with law enforcement in other states, you know, they've basically said there's a bit of a difference. We could kind of tell when there's somebody who's tapping in a few, you know, into the navigation, they're tapping in a few buttons as opposed to driving down the road for a mile with their eyes and their fingers glued to the phone texting. So that's the way they've kind of explained it to me, is that they can kind of differentiate between a few taps on the phone and somebody who's just completely distracted with their staring at the phone, you know, dialing and texting away.
It is surprising, I will say. And by the way, I'm not going to be the hypocrite. I've done this, and I'm trying to put the phone away. I've got with the iPhone, it's got the app where I can just, it shuts off while you're driving, doesn't let you use it. But I do look around and I see so many people, and I'm wondering, are you even looking up? which is very frightening. Again, I'm talking with Democratic Representative Emily Slosberg from District 91 in Palm Beach County. She's one of the leading forces behind this new law, again, awaiting the governor's signature, that would make it a primary offense if drivers are found texting while driving. Is this enough to get us to change our habits? Text us your comment on that. Let us know what you think, or if you have a question, text us to 305-602-2646. And by the way, I hope that you're not doing this while you're driving, please. Richard Florida from Miami tweeted us, probably the place that needs it most. And Cliff Post from Boca Raton said, okay, how does an officer tell if you're texting, reading your GPS or whatever? Georgia passed the smart law. Phone in your hand equals expensive ticket. Like in the UK, we want to hear from your tweet again at WLRN Sundial. This goes to the my understanding, the citation. First time offense, I think it's like 30, second time 60. If you caused an accident, then of course it gets even more intense. You said if it's in certain areas, it could be points off of your, you know, for your record. Is that enough? Do you think that it has to be tougher to scare people?
You know, I think initially it's similar to the seatbelt law, which, you know, it's a non-moving violation and it's not too hefty of a penalty. But let me tell you something, with that seatbelt law, you know, it compelled compliance going from a secondary to a primary. Compliance with the seatbelt is over 90% in the state of Florida. So, you know, if you take that over to the texting, I have a feeling we're going to have, you know, it's going to compel compliance. And we'll see whether or not the fine should be heftier as we go to see how we can gauge compliance with the law.
I wonder, too, I'm going to play a little devil's advocate with you, is the seatbelt is convincing somebody to put on this one thing at the beginning when you get in the car, put it on, that's it. Phones are different. Phones, we know from studies, are addictive. You know, answering your email, checking and tweeting or texting, all of these things, you know, if it's within reach, isn't it a little bit different? Isn't it going to be tougher, don't you think, to change behaviors?
Well, you know, now that you bring up that point, I mean, this is something that a seatbelt is my life. If I decide to put my seatbelt on, that's my life that it's affecting. But with texting and driving, that's other people's lives. That's everyone else's lives on our roadways. It's more dangerous to text and drive. And I understand the point. But I think once you start getting a violation or know that you can get a violation for this type of behavior, I think it's going to change the way you behave in your car. I absolutely think it's going to change your behavior.
Again, we want to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think this law is enough? Is it going to be enough to change behaviors? Text in your thoughts to 305-602-2646. Or you can, again, tweet us at WLRN Sundial. We heard from Miguel Luna, living in Florida for 38 years. He says, I'm a professional driver going at it now for 38 years. Finally, we have common sense individuals in our legislative seats. I've seen so many people texting on their phones while they're driving. These people are time bombs, and it's a terrible habit. But we also heard from Lewis. This is another Lewis. This is unnecessary because people get distracted for any reason. This is overreach. So again, you've heard all the different arguments on this. Coming back to what you said, though, it took a couple of years once the seatbelt laws were in place for people to change their habits, and you started to see that compliance. You think that 2 or 3 years we'll start seeing that compliance and people will start putting their phones down?
Yeah, I do. Let me also tell you, so texting while driving is the only secondary offense on our books. After, you know, well, was our only secondary offense. Every other traffic violation in the state of Florida is a primary offense. So this is just putting texting on the same treatment of every other traffic violation. And yes, I think it's going to take probably about 4 to 6 years to see a compliance get to the right level. It's possible it could be sooner, but I give it, say, 4 to 6 years.
You know, one of the things that you do with your foundation is you spend a lot of time with young people. You go to schools and you talk about, you know, safety and behind the wheel. Part of that, of course, is buckling up, but also talking about the issue of distracted driving and texting and driving. I wonder what young people say to you about that, about the whole issue with their phones and their driving. Do they get the message?
You know, it's depending on what school I'm at. Some of the students, I ask the question, I say, how many of you did your mom and your dad drive you to school today? And they all, you know, they all raise their hand. Most of them raise their hand. And then I say, how many of you did mom and dad, were they texting while they were driving you to school today? And a large proportion of them raise their hand. And then I say, well, how many of you were scared? And, you know, they all raise their hand. And so they notice they don't like being in the car when mom and dad are texting and driving them to school. So, you know, when it comes to them, you know, in other classes, you know, I believe some student drivers probably think that they could drive, they could text, and they could drive, and they could do it without being without any type of danger.
Yeah. The other thing, real quickly, before we finish up, is if you were in an accident, does law enforcement have the right to look at your phone to see if perhaps you were texting while you were driving, that could have been the cause?
All right. So the only time that law enforcement has the right to search your phone is if there is bodily injury or death after a crash. Other than that, if a law enforcement officer pulls you over, law enforcement does not have the right to search your phone for evidence of texting.
Again, this law is going to go into effect July 1st. Reading around some law enforcement agencies getting ready for this, you may not start to see that enforcement until the beginning of 2020, but either way, it's there now. It's the law. It's a primary offense, and we'll see if it does finally change some behaviors. We've also heard from some more of you. Michael said, thank you so much. Representative Schlossberg, cyclists, thank you for your efforts about the distracted driving law. I know it's going to have a big impact on the road, especially for cyclists. Santi San says, is it enough? I say it's a start. And there you go. Representative Schlossberg, again, Democrat from Boca Raton, joining us from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Representative Schlossberg, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And again, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Let us know. Do you think this law is enough? What else can we do? What else should we do to get people to focus on driving? All right. Still to come. Coming up, we're going to talk with author Dave Barry about how our dogs can teach us a lot about life. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. South Florida author Dave Barry wants to be more like his dog. His dog's name is Lucy. She's a big, beautiful black and white, black with white circles. I should say this right, around her eyes, as Dave Barry describes in his newest book, Lessons from Lucy. He'll tell us what kind of dog it is. I'm not good at that. Simple joys of an old, happy dog. She's kind of the life of the party. You could see Lucy was doing a better job at aging than Dave Barry was, or so he points out to us all the time. Lucy's teachings, by the way, led Dave to write this new book about the absurdities of his daily life and how to enjoy them as you're getting older. And we asked you, by the way, What do your pets mean in your life? We heard from a number of you, including Farrah, who tweeted, "My cat has taught me that it's never a bad time for a snuggle or a nap or snuggly nap." What lessons have you learned from your pet? We are live on Facebook, by the way, at WLRN. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. And skip all that. Dave Barry joins me now in studio. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm good. I just want to say about the nap thing. I agree with that in general and principle. Let's say this should not. Let's say you're an airline pilot approaching the landing. And first of all, you shouldn't have your cat with you in the cockpit. And second of all, even if you do and it wants to snuggle, this is not a time to take a nap. I think we need to say that because people take, this is radio and people listen to us.
No, that is very true. And again, the book is called Lessons from Lucy, The Simple Joys of an Old and Happy Dog. You know, as something I noticed, Dave, is like there's a bit of a different tone in this in other things I've read from yours. Is that, look, there's still the wit, the humor, all that, but there are these moments and it kind of took me back and you're like, you know what, Lucy and I were at that age and time's running out.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a self-help book, and I don't write self-help books. People usually, when they finish reading one of my books, they say, that didn't help me at all, or I'm actually stupider now having read that book. But this one, I hope it's funny. I wanted it to be funny, but it also has what I think is somewhat useful information, especially as you say, if you're like me and you're getting older. Well, we're all getting older, but you are now there officially old as I am. What led me to write it initially was that last year I turned 70, and which is a big one. Everybody always, well, when you're 50, when you're 60, those are milestones. 70 is, to me, is huge because the next one's 80, and no one ever says 80 is the new, 80's old. So 70's old. And at the same time I turned 70, my dog, Lucy, turned 10. And so she is, in dog years, also 70. And I was actually being, for me, pretty reflective about, life in general and where I was going, how much time I have left, and how happy I am with what I have, what I've done, and what I want to do. And it occurred to me, Lucy was just much better off handling the whole, just as dogs handle life just so much more smoothly than we do.
But you, as you mentioned in the book, you grew up with dogs.
I have always had dogs.
So, I mean, at any point were you looking at your dog, were they teaching you something? Or is it not until you got to Lucy?
Not really. Okay. My basic premise for my whole life, and I made a living writing columns about this, is dogs are not rocket scientists. I tell this story, I've told it a million times, about after Hurricane Andrew. I had two dogs at the time of Andrew. I had a large main dog named Ernest and a small emergency backup dog named Zippy. Everybody, you should have a backup dog in a hurricane in case your main dog goes down for whatever reason. And I used to let him out by a two-stage procedure every morning. And, dogs are very excited about going out in the morning. Yay! They can't believe you thought of it, even though you do it every single day. Dogs are still impressed that you came up with that idea. So in this case, it was a two-stage procedure. I'd open the back door to our house, and then we had a patio with a screen enclosure, which we have here in South Florida, so the mosquitoes will not steal our patio furniture. And so I'd open the back door, and Ernest and Sophie would run across the patio to the screen door and wait for me, because they knew they had to wait at the screen door, and I'd go and open the screen door, and they'd rush out into the yard. It's very exciting. So anyway, comes Hurricane Andrew, and the screen enclosure is orbiting the Earth. Okay, there's no screen enclosure left. But the door was still there. The screen door is just there. You know where I'm going.
Yep,
this is absolutely
yep.
true. Ernest and Zippy, I'd open the back and would run to the screen door. There was nothing preventing them from just going to the yard, but they went to the door because that was the procedure we had learned. So what I'm saying here is dogs are not geniuses. They're certain kinds of rational thinking we're capable of, they are not. But the premise of my book is that they are, even though they're not smart, they're wise. That is to say, dogs do certain things very consistently that make them happy. They are with you all the time. Whenever you're around, the dog will be with you because that makes the dog happy. Dogs like to play because it's fun for them. They will always play. If they, anytime you pick up the ball, they're ready to play. And we're like that when we're little, when we're kids. We're like, we make friends easily, we play a lot, we have fun, we pay attention to the environment. And then when you get older, all that goes away. you become more and more distracted, more and more insular, more and more less aware of your surroundings, less likely to make new friends, less likely to have fun, especially when you get to be old like me.
I'm curious though, when you went to the editors with this, and they had to know. It's like, wait a second, Dave Barry doesn't write self-help books. What is this?
No, the premise was always that it would be funny. Okay. I mean, I tried to make it the lessons.
By the way, I'm not saying this is not like a Tony Robbins book. This is it's a
God,
love.
God help us, no.
You know, unless you're going to start touring and doing that. Yeah. But no. It's these beautiful lessons, these beautiful stories that you share of experiences that and how Lucy helped you.
Yeah, and she genuinely. I mean, it took. You know, my getting old and deciding to write a book about it to actually focus on what it is she does that makes her so consistently happy, you know, and what is it that I, you know, that she does that I could do except for drinking from the toilet. Although, you know, don't knock it if you haven't tried it, I guess is the, but you know, what specific things she does, that I could do that I try to do anyway. Like, one example, which sort of I'm reminded of by your discussion with a previous guest about people texting on while they're driving, which pretty much, as far as I can tell, every single human being in Miami is doing all the time. Lucy, my dog, and I think most dogs, they don't get mad that easily and they don't hold on to anger. You know, they get like Lucy gets mad sometimes. Like we have she sits during the day in my office in the back of the house and looks out on a driveway. She keeps an eye on things. And once a week, these men come to our house. And you will not believe this. They take our garbage. They don't even ask. They just come and take it. And Lucy goes insane with rage when she sees it. She barks, looking at me. You know, she's furious. But then as soon as the men are gone, she's fine. And if they were to come in the house, she would love them to death, you know. So she doesn't have a lot of anger in her. And when she does have it, she lets it go. Whereas I, and especially this is true, I think, the older I've gotten, get furious very easily over stupid little things. Like a guy in front of, like if the light changes in Miami, the only way you're going to find out is people will be honking at the person in front who will be on the phone.
Yes.
Nobody is ever looking at the light. Why would you bother to look at the light when the people behind you will let you know by honking eventually, unless they're all on their phones too. I get furious about that behavior. And I've tried, really tried, since I wrote this book, so I was writing this book, to just calm down, because it doesn't matter that much. It never matters as much as I think it does when it's happening. There's no point in getting that angry about a 10-second delay. And yet, you know, I do it.
You describe my morning ritual. Again, talking with Dave Barry, his new book, Lessons from Lucy, The Simple Joys of an Old Happy Dog. By the way, we are live on Facebook, so you can go to Facebook right now at WLRN Sundial. And watch this interview if you'd like to do that. Granted,
are your options. You can like us with an upward thumb. You can laugh with a little. Is it the one with the tears?
There's the one. Laughing? Laughing.
You can heart us.
Or you can be angry.
Does Facebook allow that?
Yeah. I think there's an anger one, and there's also one of surprise.
Okay.
So maybe there's somebody might be surprised. I did a terrible job of describing Lucy, by the way. And there's a picture right in front of me.
Yeah, we think of her as a beautiful dog. She started out as a jet black dog when we got her. In fact, one of the reasons she was still, she was a rescue dog. And one of the reasons she was still in the rescue facility was people don't generally pick black dogs. Big reason for that is they don't photograph well. Like when we got Lucy, our daughter, Sophie, who is the reason my wife finally broke down and let us get a dog. I failed utterly to convince my wife, but Sophie broke Michelle down. And so finally we said, okay, we'll get a dog, but it has to be a rescue dog. So we go on the internet and there's all these pictures. And most of them were these cute puppies, you know, golden retrievers and stuff. And then there's this one blob, you can't see a dog at all. It's just a black thing with two glowing orbs, which were Lucy's eyes. But it looked like Demon Blob from Hell Dog. And the thing is, they put little descriptions. And the description under Lucy was, she couldn't be sweeter if she tried. She never tries to take the other dog's food. So we're looking at all these puppies, and we're saying, Sophie, do you want a puppy? Look at the puppy. And Sophie keeps coming back to the Demon Blob and saying, says he couldn't be nicer if she tried. Sophie likes that a lot. So that's, we went to meet Lucy, who came charging at us, you know, and within, we had brought another of Sophie's friends along because we wanted to make sure the dog would be good with kids. They're both 10-year-old girls. And within seconds, they're all rolling around on the ground together. And Lucy's like, you know, letting them, you know, rub her belly and everything. And we had said on the way, now, Sophie, we're not going to make the decision right away. You know, we're going to talk about this. But of course, the decision was made, you know, before they even, you know, collided in this racing together. They were already all in love, the three of them lying on the ground. So we got Lucy that way.
You had, I guess, her DNA tested to see what kind of dog she is.
Yeah, yeah, I did.
And it's like a mix of like four or five different things.
Turns out she is a member of the British royal family.
Oh, there! Yeah. Wow. Okay.
They get around those Windsors. No. What? Okay. Everybody thought she was a lab because she's a large, she's like 80 pounds now, black dog. But in fact, according to the DNA thing, she's half a boxer, a quarter Dalmatian, a quarter Chow Chow, and a quarter retriever. So she's a purebred Boxmation Chow Retriever. Oh, no, wait, I did that wrong. But half guy, I came up with one and a half.
You did.
I have one and a half dogs in there. No, I was never good at math. I'm an English major. No, but it's half boxer, quarter Dalmatian, eighth Chow Chow, eighth retriever. Whew, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Mr. Schofield, if you're listening, taught me fractions.
Again, talking with Dave Barry about his new book. And, you know, we've been asking you, by the way, is like, what lessons have you learned from your pet? How important your pets are to you? And you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Mike Hurl tweeted us, "My tabby has taught me to breathe and get rid of stress. No matter what kind of day I've had, when I walk in the door in the evening, she makes me smile and laugh. Pets give so much." Miguel Perez messaged us on Facebook, "I've learned that they love me to death." This is true. I don't have one, but I've always grown up around them. My grandmother had Basset Hounds. So just always the droopy face in the ears, licking the face all the time. You're right. You leave for 10 minutes, 10 days.
And it doesn't matter. When you get back, it's the most exciting and the best thing. Nobody ever will love anybody the way a dog loves a person. And that's what, you know, in the end, that's what it comes down to. People just get so much from having some relationship that is that deep and intense and uncluttered by any kind of agendas or anything else. The dog just loves you. The dog just wants to be with you. And, you know, again, not to get corny, but that's kind of one of the lessons is we really ought to feel that more that way more about each other, about, you know, human to human as we do. But we have so much in the way. We get so wrought with, you know, so many things happen that make us unable to just give that love, you know, and dogs don't have those problems.
I was thinking about, I mean, you have these eight lessons and they make sense. But I think, as you said, you know, you get to a certain point in life, and I'm young, but I'm nearing the big 50, and I'm thinking about things.
You're a baby.
I'm a baby to you. I know that's
child.
But at the same time, you know, you talk about, like, you know, some of the lessons you've learned. Don't stop having fun. Make friends easier. Things like that, and don't hold on to. You know what? Don't. One of them was, don't take things for granted. And I'm thinking to myself, but you get caught up in your ways, and then you don't even think about that, and then changing gets hard.
Yeah, the world is so full of distractions for people, and dogs are so good at ignoring almost all of them, except the ones that are really, really important to the dog, like the smell of the other dog's urine, which unfortunately is one of them. But that doesn't usually get in the way of our. But yeah, the world is so full of distraction, and a good example of that, which I talk about some in the book, is like, and this is not a new observation on my part, but if you go to a funeral, somebody you loved. Everybody kind of has the same reaction, which is, oh man, that person's now gone. I never will talk to that person again. And there are all these times when I could have and I didn't, or I, you know, I said, and that's gone now. That opportunity's not here anymore. I will not let that happen again with my loved ones. I am going to be better from now on. I think everyone who goes to a funeral that really moves them comes out feeling some form of that emotion. Then you walk out, and within 10 minutes, your phone beeps or something, you know, and you're back to, because this is important. I have to deal with this. Oh, the car needs, these things are important. I got to deal with that. You know? And then none of those things, when you really get down to it, is important as saying to somebody you love, I love you. But at the moment, they all seem more important. And so you put that off and put it off and put it off and put it off. And then next thing you know, you're at a funeral again. And yeah.
Of the eight lessons, though, which ones have been the easiest for you?
The easiest for me is, like, don't try not to take looks too seriously. I'm dogs don't care what anybody looks like. That's one of the wonderful things about it. If you ever look at, when two dogs meet each other, they don't even look at each other's faces. They go straight to each other's butts. I guess that matters to them. But I'm not recommending that either. But they don't, you know, they don't form a relationship or make a judgment based on how you look.
Right.
Lucy loves everybody. It doesn't matter who you are, what you look like. Lucy loves you as soon as she meets you. We're not good about that, but I think I'm better than a lot of people about that, because I never thought of myself as, you know, I never was competing in the looks department in my, you know, in my, like, my self-image. So I'm, like, happy with the idea that you can judge people, you know, on something other than appearance. I put that in there because I think it's important, and because we are in a society where, you know, especially if you're like young women, I have a daughter, where that they're just, you know, it's kind of drilled into them how important looks are.
Yeah.
Not, you know, through the commercials and that sort of thing.
Right.
So, and dogs are good about that.
So which one's the hardest one?
Hardest for me has been making friends. I've never been great about it. I'm a shy person to begin with. All people don't believe that, but it's true. And the older I got, the more I realized I don't need any friends. I don't even like the friends I have. You know, I'm not even sure my dear friends that I love very much are all still alive. Because to find out, I would have to call them up, and I'm too busy being old. You know, that has been tough. And you know, so I have made a point of reconnecting with friends. I've started calling people, and it's hard for a guy to call another guy. I think women are way better at that. They'll call up, I just wanted to say hi. You don't do that to another guy. There has to be a reason. Like, you need his kidney. There has to be a reason you call another guy. And so it's harder to do that, but I've tried. What is really hard for me is making new friends.
Yeah,
it's hard. It's difficult for me to come up with a basis for a friendship at my age.
I try to explain this to the young workers here. I can't let you go without asking about this. This book, I mean, it got us thinking. A lot of us were joking, I got to get a dog now. It definitely put us in tears. We were looking, you know, especially, and not to give anything away, but, you know, one of the chapters talks about an experience you had recently with your daughter.
Yeah.
And how Lucy really helped you get through this. Your daughter, she had an illness, and all of a sudden everybody's lives changed.
Yeah. The last chapter of the book wasn't supposed to be there. I finished this book last year. I was supposed to be going on book tour last October. My daughter, Sophie, was getting ready to go to college in August. Woke up one morning paralyzed, not going to go too much detail, and I will say right now she's okay, but it
getting
was
ready to go to school.
She is in school.
She
just completed. She started late, but she got through. Completed the second a semester. Anyway, not to get complicated, but she's good. She's walking. She's going to school. But it was the most terrifying time I've ever. Just every parent's worst nightmare was ours, and we just lived this awful experience. And what came out of that, weirdly enough, the lesson. When that happened, I first of all said I can't go on a book tour. I'm sorry, and I don't know if I'll ever want to go on a book tour now, because I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. When it looked like it was going to be okay, I went back to the publisher and said I have to write another chapter. I can't go out and talk about life lessons without this one.
Yeah.
And the lesson, weirdly enough, was gratitude, which is the last thing I thought I was going to feel after this horrible experience watching my daughter suffer. But when that happened, when you're in a hospital, you know, day and night for weeks and weeks, and you don't know what's going to happen, and nobody's promising you a good outcome, you suddenly realize what's important in life. And to us, the only thing important to us was our daughter's health. We didn't care anymore about our careers. We didn't care what was going on in politics or the economy or anything else. We didn't care about anything but that. And when that came back, when we got that back, we were so grateful. And we look, you know, so what I say in the book is, if you look around at your life and you think it's not so great, but you think about it, if you wake up in the morning and you can walk, and your daughter, your son, your kids are healthy, your grandkids are healthy, reasonably healthy. If you have that much, it doesn't really matter what else, that you have a pretty good life. Because if you lost that, you would realize how unimportant all the stuff you think is important is.
Yeah.
This is what's important. It's just not much. And you should be grateful every day for it. And I have to say, that's the biggest change in my life was that. Like, Michelle and I talk about this all the time. We wake up, Sophie's okay. It's a good day. It's a good world. We're okay. You know, that's the rest of it. We can just you know, our roof leaks, which it did this week. Like, okay, that's fine. It's a leak in the roof.
Yeah.
That is not the same as losing your health, losing your loved one's health.
Beautiful lessons again from, well, we always learn lessons from our pets. Again, the book is called Lessons from Lucy, The Simple Joys of an Old and Happy Dog, Dave Barry. Such a joy, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, same here, Liz. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. And you know what? It's just it's a fun read. Look, trust me, it's not self-help. It's actually...
yeah, I ended on a sort of a sad note there.
It's still funny. It's really, really... It's Dave Barry, for heaven's sake. So that's our program for today, this Tuesday, May 14th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Don't forget me.